explain, Donahue says to me. Shooting myself, which I certainly didn't do, would make no sense, I add. And which is it? Because I'm confused. I'm lying to cover for Lucy? Or I'm lying about attempting to kill myself? Maybe you have another theory to add to the mix. Did you feel panicked? Erin is having a harder time keeping her composure. When you realized you were shot, did you feel panic? You don't have to answer that, Donahue says. Have you ever entertained even the slightest doubt that the person who shot you was Carrie Greffin? Erin tastes blood. You don't have to answer that. Has it ever occurred to you, Dr. Scarpetta, that in your panic, you thought it was her but you were mistaken? You don't have to answer that. That's fine, because I really didn't understand the question. I'm confused by yet another theory. My attention is on the river beyond the window, on the slow eddies and ruffles. The water is the greenish color of old bottle glass as it languidly bends around the point of land Lucy owns. An image flashes in my mind. I see my face through a fogged-up dive mask in murky, muddy water. I see myself dead. I'm sorry, Erin says with a chilliness that's about to freeze over. Let me try again. Has it ever entered your mind that the person you saw might have been someone else? You don't have to answer that. Oh, I see. We're off the suicide theory and back to my being shot by someone, I reply. Isn't it more likely, Erin continues her disjointed line of questioning, that during the nanosecond you saw this person, you made an instant assumption it was Carrie Greffin? You didn't know it, you assumed it, and why wouldn't you? Certainly she was on your mind. You don't have to answer that either, Donahue says. You were justified in fearing her, looking over your shoulder every minute. Erin is baiting me, trying to make me react. Therefore, wouldn't it be fair to conclude that if you were looking for her, then that's who you imagined you saw in the nanosecond we're talking about? She's going to persist in using the word nanosecond. She's practicing for a jury, making the case that the encounter happened so fast I didn't really see anything. Therefore, I didn't see who shot me. I simply feared who it might be and made an assumption that I won't back down from. Or if that story doesn't work, then I suppose she can resort to painting me as a crazy person who speared herself for God knows what reason. After several more minutes of this, Donahue says she needs to talk privately with her client. I've never been here before, she says to me for Erin's benefit. Do you mind showing me around, Kay? It looks absolutely breathtaking. We walk out into the corridor and follow red Jarrah wood flooring slowly, quietly, beneath mica lamps that glow a pleasant coppery yellow. I'm aware of Lucy's security system, of every keypad, camera, and motion sensor we pass. I'm mindful that there can be no assumption of privacy. Is there anything in particular you'd like to see? I ask Donahue a seemingly innocuous question, as I'm mindful of cameras all over Lucy's house. I noticed when I first walked in that if I'd taken a right instead of a left, there seemed to be an area of interest at the end of that hallway. Her casual comment points out a serious problem. What she's referring to is the guest suite Lucy renovated for me. It's my bedroom, my private space when I stay here. As we get closer to the entranceway, I can see what Donahue is talking about. Beyond it is another hallway. At the far end of it, the door to my suite is open. As we get closer, a man in a cheap khaki suit emerges with a large, sealed, brown paper package that he carries in both arms. Strong and sinewy, he's dark with glittering brown eyes, his hair cropped close to his scalp on the sides and a buzz cut on top. He looks military. Afternoon, he says, as if we're on the same team. Can I help you with something? Where are you taking that and why? Donahue indicates the brown paper package he clutches. Oh, now, I wouldn't want to bog you down in every little thing we're doing here, but you can't go in there right now. I'm Doug Wade. And you're? Jill Donahue. May I see your badge? I'd be happy to if I had one, he says. But I'm just a revenue officer for the IRS. We don't get badges, guns. Nothing fun like that. When I reach my room, I don't step in, but I make my presence known. I stand in the open doorway, watching two agents strip my queen-size bed, flipping the mattress over and halfway off the frame, piling the honey-colored Egyptian cotton linens on the floor. Their gloved hands feel carefully for any hint of a hiding place. They aren't IRS, unless they're looking for a mattress full of untaxed money. They're looking for something else. But what? More rifles? A spear gun? My dive mask? Drugs? Through the open closet door, I can see my clothing, my shoes, sloppily returned to shelves that were riffled through. I confirm that my iMac computer is missing from the desk inside my country office with its river view. Lucy worked hard to make my guest quarters exactly what she thought I'd like. A lot of glass, a colorful silk rug on the shiny cherry floor, copper light fixtures, a coffee bar, a gas fireplace, and large photographs of Venice. I've enjoyed many contented, cozy times here, innocent, gentle hiatuses that I may never have again. I feel my anger picking up steam as I think of the large, brown-wrapped package I just watched go by. My mind races through what might be on the desktop or stored in documents. What might the IRS or FBI or some other agency see that could be a problem? I'm diligent about dumping files and emptying the trash, but that won't stop government labs from recovering everything that was on my computer. Lucy could have scrubbed the hard drive and ensured that nothing deleted could be restored, but I assume she didn't have time. She claims she didn't know her property was being raided until Aaron Loria called the house phone and announced her presence, and that would have given Lucy only minutes to take care of any security concerns. But I don't know what's true. She can be as manipulative and untruthful as the FBI. Maybe that's where she learned it. Good morning, I say. And both agents look up at me, neither of them a day over 40. Typically well-groomed and buff in their cargo pants and polo shirts. Am I being audited? I sure hope not, because that's no fun, one of them says cheerfully. I'm just wondering if I'm being audited, and if that's the explanation for why an IRS revenue agent just walked off with my computer, which, by the way, I don't believe is proper. It's my understanding that revenue agents can't just enter a private residence without permission. Did Lucy give the IRS permission? No answer. Did her partner Janet? Nothing. Well, for sure I know I didn't, I say to them. So I'm wondering who gave the IRS permission to search this house and remove personal property from it. Not just my niece's personal property, but also mine. We're really not at liberty to discuss an active investigation, ma'am, the other agent says curtly, loudly. If I'm the target of an active investigation and am being audited, I have a right to know. Isn't that true? I ask Donahue, but I don't need her to answer. And I'm confused and find it necessary to continue to point out that revenue agents aren't allowed to simply help themselves to whatever they decide to carry off site. I'm playing them, and they know it. Their smiles are gone. You'll have to take it up with them, ma'am, the loud, curt agent says. And his tone is sharper. We don't work for the IRS. I'm not certain the man in the khaki suit who just walked out with the iMac works for the IRS either. He didn't look like the type, not like any auditor I've ever met. Also, he introduced himself as a revenue officer, not a revenue agent, and officers are usually assigned to cases that involve unpaid tax debts while agents conduct audits. I don't know why either type of IRS employee would be inside Lucy's house. This is my attorney, and I'm glad she's a witness to your active investigation, I then say. A picture's worth a thousand words. You gentlemen have a nice day. How did they know this is your room? Donahue asks me as we walk away. How did you know it's my room? I ask her back. Because I overheard someone make a reference when I first walked into the house. I caught words to the effect that what they just packed up was the doc's computer, and to make sure it's clear, the contents of that room are yours, she explains. They had no doubt about it. Any reason to think you might have a problem with the IRS? No more reason than anybody else that I'm aware of. And Lucy? I have nothing to do with her finances. She doesn't discuss them with me. I do assume she pays her taxes, I reply. Why might the IRS investigate her for tax crimes? There's no reason I'm aware of. I don't add that Doug Wade in his khaki suit isn't that kind of IRS employee. If he were empowered to investigate suspected criminal tax offenses, he would have a gun and a badge. Special agents for the IRS also usually travel in pairs. I don't say there's something fishy about who Doug Wade is and why he's here, but I'm quite sure it's not for the reasons that meet the eye. The FBI has an agenda. It won't be one that's palatable, or in this case, even justified. More to the point, I'm saying to Donahue loud enough for everyone to hear, the feds have a right to anything that's mine? Just because it happens to be inside Lucy's house? I already know what she'll say, but that doesn't stop me from hoping for a loophole, and I'm in a mood to remind the FBI that I won't be bullied. Anything on the premises, they have a warrant to search, and it's open season, she says. They would argue that they have no way of knowing whether laptops all over the place are Lucy's or belong to someone else, such as Janet or yourself. They would argue that the only way to be certain is to examine the contents. In other words, they get to do what they want. In other words, yes, she says. They pretty much do. Outside the house in the stifling heat, I don't see any agents walking about. And I look at the vehicles parked in front. A caravan of four white Tahoes. Behind them is a black Ford sedan, and I wonder who it belongs to. Maybe the phony IRS agent. The helicopter is gone, and I hear the wind in the trees and the distant kettle drums of thunder. Clouds to the south are rising like the Great Wall of China, building formidably like an edifice you can see from outer space. The air is humid and ominous. Why? Donahue looks up at the threatening sky. Why what? Why did they have a helicopter here? What the hell was it doing? It circled for how long? The better part of an hour. Maybe they're filming everything that goes on down here. For what reason? Political caution, Donahue decides. And what she means is public embarrassment or looking bad. I suggest we head down to the dock. I point out every lamppost and some of the trees that have cameras with audio. I'm slowly picking my way down wooden steps that lead from the backyard to the water's edge. It's low tide, and I smell the swampy odor of decomposing vegetation, and the hot, flat air has gotten still. Simmering with violent promise. To the south, threatening clouds are building rapidly. We're about to get a severe thunderstorm, and I don't want the damn FBI here when it hits. I don't want them tracking water and mud in and out. They've done enough damage. Our footsteps are hollow thuds on the weathered gray wooden dock. The boathouse is built on pilings, and underneath are colorful kayaks that are rarely used. Lucy has little interest in any mode of transportation that doesn't include an engine. I suspect that anything requiring a paddle was Janet's idea. How was your status conference this morning? I lead us around to the front of the boathouse as I think about data fiction, about a case Donahue apparently was discussing in federal court this morning. Benton was there. Does data fiction have anything to do with why the FBI is here now? I don't ask directly, and Donahue isn't saying anything. I was just wondering because you brought it up. I don't say what she brought up, but she understands what I'm suggesting. Yes, I did, she finally answers me. There was a motion made that the case be dismissed because the evidence can't be trusted. Based on? I think it's the nature of digital media that we should assume it can be corrupted, she replies. And as she continues to talk cautiously and shrewdly, it dawns on me that she was the attorney who requested this dismissal. Donahue is a powerful, skilled attorney who wouldn't miss the slightest opportunity to make a jury question the integrity of every aspect of the prosecution's case. For her, data fiction would be a dream come true. But I have to wonder about the timing. Why today? Why was Benton there? Why is the FBI on Lucy's property? It's all connected, I say under my breath, and then I hear it again. The C-sharp chord on an electric guitar. I look at the message that's just landed on my phone, and Donahue can tell by my face that I'm upset. Is everything all right? She stares pointedly at my phone and says very quietly, barely moving her lips, use extreme caution. I'm sure they've seized her networks. I stop walking. I need a minute. Is it anything I can help you with? She continues her careful conversation. It's quite a view Lucy has here. I look out at the water, and Donahue knows not to question me further. I've been sent a communication she shouldn't see. And if what I'm about to find relates to criminal activity, then she doesn't need the exposure. It's bad enough that I have it. And I watch her walk ahead of me as I stand alone on the pier and put on my earpiece again. I face the river and hold my phone close, protecting any sliver of privacy I might have, calculating the most likely location for Lucy's cameras and holding my back to them, tucking myself in, preparing for something else that will be difficult for me to watch. Like the other two messages, this one appears to have been sent from Lucy's ice line. And there's no text, nothing but a link. I click on it, and without delay, the video starts inside Lucy's dorm room again. Then the credits begin to roll by, dripping down slowly in blood-red type. Depraved Heart, Video 3, by Cary Grethen, July 11, 1997. Chapter 19. She stops reading, and her nimble pale fingers quickly fold the sheets of white, unlined paper with their script format. Cary tucks the envelope into the army green backpack as the door closes in the background, and the camera picks up Lucy walking into the dorm room. It appears she has showered since the last video I watched, and this reinforces my growing conviction that the recordings were knitted together to convey a message. I need to pay close attention, no matter how manipulative and uncomfortable. It's crucial I remember everything I'm hearing and seeing, because the video likely will self-destruct when it's finished playing. Lucy's hair is damp. She has on faded jeans, a green FBI polo shirt, and flip-flops. Carrying an armful of folded underwear, shorts, shirts, and socks tucked into balls, she drops everything on the foot of the bed as Mr. Pickle's amber eyes watch glassily. Yours is on top, she says coldly to Cary, without looking at her. Pretty much everything that's white is yours. Funny, but I usually don't associate all white with bad guys. I thought I asked you to leave. Why the fuck are you still here? It's subjective who's bad and who's good. And you don't really want me to leave. It's not subjective, and you need to get the hell out. I wear white for the same reason you should. Chronic exposure to chemical dyes is toxic. Cary tucks her white clothes into the backpack. I know you don't pay attention to such mundane minutiae because you think you'll never have to worry about anything aging you, or God forbid, giving you a neurological disorder or cancer or destroying your immune system so your own body is chronically attacking itself. Not a good way to die. There's no good way to die. There are plenty of bad ones, though, Carrie says. Better to be shot. Better to be killed in a plane crash. You don't want to be sick or poisoned. You don't want to linger and lose your functionality. Imagine brain damage. Or being old, and that's the worst offender and biggest enemy, and what I intend to defeat. You mean with your stupid creams that have copper in them? Someday you'll think back on this moment and wish you'd done everything differently. I mean, absolutely everything. Her stare is unwavering. She doesn't blink. Very nice of you to do the laundry. Was it busy? I had to wait forever for a dryer. I hate sharing. Lucy is in a withdrawn, leaden mood, and she won't look at her. My, my, how entitled we are. You should hear yourself. Have we forgotten that you're the only elitist on this floor who doesn't have a roommate or share a bathroom? Shut up, Carrie. You're 19, Lucy. Shut the hell up! You're a child. You shouldn't even be here. I want the MP5K back. Where is it? It's safe. It's not yours. It's not yours either. We're so much alike. Are you aware of that? We aren't anything alike. Lucy puts away clothes, yanking open drawers and slamming them shut. But we're exactly alike, Carrie says. We're different sides of the same ice cube. What the fuck does that even mean? Carrie pulls her tank top, her sports bra, off over her head, and half naked she faces Lucy. I don't believe what you said. You didn't mean it. You love me. You can't live without me. I know you didn't mean it. Lucy stares at her, then shoves shut another drawer while Carrie leaves her sweaty clothing on the floor where it fell. I notice there's no visible line of demarcation on her exposed flesh. No variations in pigmentation. Her breasts, belly, her back and neck, all of her is the same opaque, milky white. It's not like Benton won't eventually figure out it's missing, Lucy says. Where the hell is it? This isn't funny. Just give it back and leave me alone. I can't wait to restore it to its proper condition and do some test fires when it's all packed up in its fancy briefcase. Just imagine it. You're standing on a busy sidewalk holding your briefcase as the motorcade goes by. Whose motorcade? Lucy stares at her. There are so many choices. You're sicker than I ever imagined. Don't be so dramatic. Carrie retrieves the St. Pauli girl from the desk and takes a swallow of it inches from Lucy's face. I know you didn't mean what you said earlier. She leans against her, drinking the beer, sliding a hand under Lucy's shirt. Don't. She pulls Carrie's hand away. And water doesn't have sides, and an ice cube is water, so as usual, you're full of shit. Am I? Carrie kisses her, and their faces disconcertingly mirror each other. Don't, Lucy says. Both of them have sharp features, keen eyes, strong jaws, straight white teeth, and extreme agility and gracefulness. It's not surprising. Benton says Carrie is the classic narcissist who falls in love with herself, moving from one image of herself to the next. The world is a mirrored room filled with her own projections, and she met her match with Lucy. Benton describes Carrie as Lucy's doppelganger, her evil double. Don't, Carrie. No. They're both exquisitely toned like Olympic runners, 5'8" with ample breasts, narrow hips, six-pack abs, and chiseled arms, quads, and calves. They easily could pass for sisters. No! Lucy pulls back from her. Stop! Why did you say it? Carrie doesn't take her eyes off her. You know you can't possibly leave me. I'm going to dinner, and when I come back, you'd better not be here. Lucy's voice trembles, and she sits on the edge of the desk and starts putting on socks and black leather trainers. Tell Marino happy birthday. Carrie stands aggressively close to her. I hope you have fun at the Globe and Laurel. Be sure to tell him why I'm not there. You're not invited. You never were and shouldn't have expected otherwise, and you wouldn't have wanted to go anyway. I wouldn't have missed it, but I understand. He should be surrounded by his favorite people at his favorite hangout. Carrie's eyes are cold blue steel. I'll give you money to buy him a round of drinks or a special dessert with a candle on it. He doesn't want you there, and he doesn't want your money. It's not nice, though. Not inviting me to the big birthday party, Carrie says. Watch out. A poison apple may follow. You know damn well you can't have dinner with us. Let me guess whose idea it was to exclude me tonight. Not Marino's. It was your precious Auntie Kay. It's true she has the lowest opinion of you that she could possibly have of any human being I've ever been with, will ever be with. Don't be so boring. You're so pathologically controlling and competitive. Lucy is pacing the room, getting increasingly agitated. And you're immature and tedious, and when you're like that, you're boring. Carrie says it in a dead voice as she stands perfectly still, perfectly calm near the desk. I hate being bored. I might just hate it more than anything. Except I wouldn't want to lose my freedom. Which would you hate more, Lucy Boo? Being dead or being in prison? Lucy walks into the bathroom. She fills a glass with water from the sink and returns to the bedroom, where Carrie is near the desk, playing with the Swiss Army knife. Why did you say it? You haven't before. Carrie perseverates with no inflection in her voice. Lucy clears her throat and averts her eyes. Don't make this harder than it already is. You're being petulant. Carrie watches her with reptilian steadiness. I'm not. Lucy clears her throat again as she drinks water. Of course, this is you acting out, Carrie is saying, because you couldn't possibly leave me. You can't really act on your threat and never have been able to. Just look at you. You're about to cry. You're about to completely disintegrate at the mere thought of not being with me. You love me more than you've ever loved anyone in your life. You loved me first. I'm your first love, and you know how that works. Actually, you don't. You're a child compared to me. But file this away. Carrie's index finger tap, tap, taps her temple. You never forget your first, she says slowly and with emphasis. You never get over it, because it will always be the most intense thing you ever felt, your most unbearable desire and lust. The crush, the blushing, the thumping in the chest, the rushing and roaring of blood up your neck to your brain that lifts the top of your skull. You can't think. You can't talk. All you want to do is touch. You want to touch the person so badly you would kill to do it. Is there anything better than lust? You're fucking around with the beauty queen, so I guess you should know all about lust. We're done. You sure? Carrie stares at the bulky red Swiss Army knife in the palm of her hand. Because you'd better mean it. Words can change everything. Be careful what you mean or don't. I should have known from the first time we met. Lucy paces faster, gesturing furiously. When they escorted me into the ERF and turned me over to you, my supervisor, my mentor, my personal plague. That wasn't the first time I met you, Lucy. It was just the first time you met me. Carrie rubs the knife with her thumb, testing its sharpness. Come here. You need to take it easy. You're a cheat and a fake, a fraud, an intellectual thief, and that's the worst kind, because you're stealing someone's soul. I created Cain, and that's what you can't stand. All along, you've taken the credit for what I, in fact, did. You trick people out of whatever it is you decide you want. Oh my God, we're back to that. Carrie laughs. The Criminal Artificial Intelligence Network, and who should get all the thanks? Who would get it if you're truthful? Lucy's eyes blaze, and she gets in Carrie's face. Who invented the name, the acronym CAIN? Who wrote all the code that really matters? I can't believe how much I've allowed you to use me. You'll probably hurt me worse before it's over. Before what's over? Everything. If I plan to hurt you, you won't know about it until I decide, Carrie says, as gunshots sound like faraway fireworks from a celebration about to end. She grabs Lucy, kissing her hard, and Lucy cries out in shocked pain. I see the Swiss Army knife in Carrie's hand, the small, shiny steel blade. I watch blood darkening Lucy's green shirt, staining her fingers bright red as she clutches her abdomen, staring at Carrie dazed, enraged, disbelieving, and devastated. What did you do? Lucy screams at her. What the hell did you just do, you fucking lunatic? The mark of the beast. Carrie grabs a towel and lifts Lucy's shirt, dabbing blood flowing from a horizontal incision in the lower left quadrant of her belly. In case you forget who you really belong to. Jesus Christ! Holy fucking shit! What have you done? Lucy jerks the towel away from her, and then nothingness. The display on my phone goes black. Chapter 20. The front porch is arranged with teakwood lounge chairs that have bright green cushions and matching ottomans. Water laps against the pilings, the river a quarter of a mile wide here, with uninhabited forests on the other side. I watch a pair of bald eagles soar high over the leafy canopy of hardwoods and evergreens. I'm reminded that there are a lot of nests around here, and I'm annoyed all over again about the FBI helicopter thundering over this quiet conservation land, unsettling the wildlife, upsetting everything imaginable. Under different circumstances, the boathouse would be a perfect spot to sit and have a drink at the end of an awful day like this. And I wonder why Lucy hasn't stepped outside to meet us. She should have noticed our approach. She probably has 50 security cameras on her property, and as we've made our way here, we're being monitored. It's strange she hasn't walked out to greet us, and I knock on the front door. I hear laughter, music, people speaking Japanese, a television playing. The sound of the lock, and Lucy opens up, and my eyes involuntarily drop down to her gray t-shirt as if I expect to see blood, as if Carrie just cut her with the small blade of a Swiss Army knife that Marino gave to her. I remember it was after he'd begun taking her to deserted parking lots, teaching her to ride his Harley, and he told her she should never be without tools. Always have money in your pocket and some sort of blade handy, I remember him advising her in the early years. Carrie picked that knife, Marino's knife. She used it to mark Lucy, to hurt her, and I envisioned the delicate, colorful dragonfly tattoo on the lower left quadrant of Lucy's abdomen. The first time I saw it, she explained that dragonflies are the helicopters of the insect world, and that was the inspiration. It wasn't. The inspiration was a scar she'd never want anybody to know about. It would shame her. She especially didn't want me to learn the truth. Hi. Lucy holds the door. You didn't see us? I ask. I'm not watching who's on my property because I already know. Lucy replies as Donahue and I walk in. And more importantly, I know what they don't. Which is, Donahue asks her, what I know as opposed to what they know? It's a very long list. I'm about to tell you some of what's on it. Only if it's safe to talk, Donahue says. I'm gonna get into that, too. Lucy shuts the door. This stinks. Marino is seated on the couch and careful with his language. What he really wants to say is this is fucked up or it sucks, but he has a 7-year-old sitting next to him. Can't you do something? He asks Donahue. This is ridiculous. What about unlawful search and seizure? What about malicious prosecution? Legally, I can't do anything. Not yet. What damn judge would sign a court order allowing all this? Marino reaches for a mug on the end table, and I spot the Keurig in the kitchen. One who probably knows Aaron Loria's federal judge husband, I suggest. Does anybody need coffee? Well, it's not right. It's like, where the hell are we? Russia? North Korea? Marino complains. I don't disagree that this seems pretty extreme and outrageous. A coffee would be nice, Donahue says to me. Yeah, it's totally effed up, that's what it is, Marino adds from his end of the couch. In the middle is Desi, and next to him is Janet. And I hear Jet Ranger before I spot him under the breakfast table snoring. I bend down to pat his head and silky ears, and he licks my hand and wags his stump of a tail as I walk to the kitchen counter. I make coffee as I take an inventory of my surroundings, starting with the 60-inch flat screen on the wall. It's been switched from security to TV mode, and a Japanese sitcom is playing softly on Tokyo Broadcasting System. No one is remotely interested. That's not why the show is on. The flat screen is more than a TV or a monitor, I decide, as coffee streams loudly into a mug. What Lucy has in here is a device such as a base station that scrambles mobile phone communications, and whoever intercepts the encrypted data stream will hear nothing but static. I look around at built-in speakers, at the thick cypress walls and triple-glazed glass that's reflective from the outside so people can't see in. I've been in here before, not often, but on occasion, and this is the first time it's occurred to me that the boathouse isn't merely a boathouse. Lucy has set up a sound masking system, and I wonder if it's a new addition like her rock garden. She's anticipated for a while that she was going to be visited by the feds. Since mid-June, at least. Since I was shot. That's my guess. They've not been in here? I ask Lucy as I hand a coffee to Donahue. They did a sweep. I told them they had to do it first and get out because we needed a quiet place for Desi and Jet Ranger. How nice of them to accommodate, Donahue says wryly. I demanded a quiet, safe place for them. Yes, how very kind and sensitive of the FBI to comply with your wishes, I say pointedly, because the FBI isn't kind or sensitive, and they don't care about Lucy's wishes. Rather unusual, don't you think? I look around at the built-in speakers and up at the ceiling tiles. They didn't fight you on it or insist on having an agent in here with you. No. You're saying they have no concern about your home improvements? I speak euphemistically, still unconvinced that our conversation is safe. There's nothing they can do about how I've chosen to construct my house and any associated outbuildings. A search warrant doesn't grant them permission to destroy someone's property, Lucy says, and she's right, but in theory only. FBI agents aren't supposed to damage belongings or disable someone's residential infrastructure or deliberately create a security liability. But that doesn't mean they won't. It doesn't mean they'll have any problem trumping up a justification for their actions. I wonder if they recognize the sound masking system in here, and if so, why they didn't insist that the boathouse is off limits. Why, really? What is the actual reason they're permitting us to hole up in here, And is there any way at all they could have us under surveillance, despite Lucy's protestations that it's not possible? She swears we're safe when I ask about it again just now. She swears everything we're discussing is private. But I continue to have my doubts, no matter what she swears. I don't trust a damn thing. I hope you're right and we're okay. I hold Lucy's gaze. How about everybody else? Is everyone okay? I direct this at Janet as I walk to the couch. How are you and Desi doing? I give them a hug, and Janet is cool and composed. It's her nature, her personality, to be that way, and my attention lingers on her youthful, attractive face. She's not wearing makeup. Her short blonde hair is messy, as if she's been running her fingers through it, and her nails are dirty. She's wearing scrubs, and I happen to know she sleeps in scrubs, but she doesn't lounge in them. I've never seen her wear them around the house, except right before bed or when she first gets up. It's lunchtime, and she's unkempt and in scrubs, and it means something I need to figure out. If the FBI got here mid-morning, then what were Lucy and Janet doing before that? I'm quite certain they weren't relaxing. When I hugged Janet just now and kissed her cheek, I tasted salt. I picked up the loamy, pungent odors of soil mingled with the vague, musky scent of sweat. Lucy was sweaty, too. Perhaps they were doing some type of yard work earlier today. They don't do yard work. They have a lawn service and a landscaper. I look around at built-in bookshelves, the exposed beams, the gray slate floor, the kitchenette with its gas stovetop and stainless steel sinks and appliances, and the backsplash of Venetian glass tiles the color of smoke. The boathouse is bright and simple, a small living area and a bath. It's clean, but has the empty patina of places rarely used. Maybe only when Lucy needs to scramble conversations, or when she's feeling hunted. And possibly she feels that way more than I've realized. We're safe in here. Lucy watches me taking in everything around us. It's the only place on the property that's completely safe right now. They can't hear us. I promise. They can't see us. As long as we stay inside. And they're permitting this? Donahue asks dubiously, and Lucy laughs. They are, but they don't have a clue what they're permitting. The boathouse is on a secure wireless network that, suffice it to say, is hidden. She is suddenly smug and mirthful, and just as quickly she ducks back behind her somberness. But I saw it. She has the FBI outsmarted, or at least she believes she does. Nothing would amuse her more. There are other features that make this foolproof. I'm not going to go into it. She looks at Donahue, then back at me. You don't need to know anything more than that we're safe in here right this minute. Are you sure? I sip my coffee and realize how much I need it. Absolutely sure. Yes. Then I'm going to talk freely. Chapter 21. Go ahead, Lucy says. You think they're after the dive mask I was wearing. I don't ask. I tell. You think they're on your property because of the video captured by the mini recorder mounted on my mask, a mask I've been led to believe was never recovered. I don't really know why they're here. It could be about that, Lucy says. It could also be about more than one thing, she adds, as if that's what she really thinks. I've not heard anything about a missing mask or a mini recorder. Donahue has moved to a mission-style chair across from the couch, and she has a yellow legal pad and pen out. There's been no mention of them in the news, I reply. Well, there's plenty else about what happened in Florida, including the two police divers murdered and you being almost murdered. Donahue directs this at me. But let me guess, Lucy says. You don't recall seeing the name Carrie Grethen anywhere. No, I haven't. And you won't. It's Janet who says this. The FBI will deny her existence. They're denying it, and will continue to do so. How can you be sure of this? Donahue asks her. Because I know them. Clearly, there's a lot you need to brief me about, Kay. Donahue writes down the name Carrie Greffin in capital letters and circles it. I realize that. They didn't want to alert anybody that the mask is missing, Lucy says, or is believed to be missing. It's stupid. It's not even logical. They being the FBI, Donahue assumes. Yes, Lucy says. They've been managing the press releases about what happened in Fort Lauderdale. How could you know anything about it? I ask. Why would you know anything about how they're handling the media? My search engines. I see everything that goes out. She's hacking. There's been no mention of the missing mask, which is dumb as hell, since the person they're trying to keep that detail from is the person who shot you, she's saying to me. That person is Carrie, and she knows damn well the mask you had on is missing because she's the reason it's missing. And on the video, you can see this. You can see her take my mask. I hope it's true, but don't understand how it can be. When I realized my mask was missing, it made sense that Carrie might have ripped it off my face as a parting gesture. She would have recognized the camera embedded above the nosepiece. I can imagine her wanting the recording. She didn't rip off your mask, Lucy says, but she definitely would want the recording. Then how did my mask come off? I understand I was spitting out the regulator. Benton says I was, but he never mentioned I took my mask off, too. Certainly he wouldn't have done it. I'm feeling more uncertain as I say all this. And he wouldn't have allowed her to get close enough to me to rip off my mask. I'm becoming less sure of everything with each minute that passes. I can't imagine it happening like that. She didn't get any closer, Aunt Kay. She shot you and then was out of sight. Out of sight? She wasn't caught on camera? I begin to get a cold feeling, a terrible one that clenches my gut. Your mask got knocked off when you were struggling, when you were being pulled around by the rope attached to the spear and the surface buoy, Lucy says. And I try to stay positive as I feel the boom about to drop. Good. Fine. So we have documentation. I'm deluding myself now, but can't seem to stop. So we're beginning to put the pieces together to show exactly what happened and who's responsible. My spirits lift, even as I fail to comprehend how any of this makes sense. I wish it were that simple. Lucy begins her wind-up for the bad news that will follow. Carrie doesn't need to find out from the media that this critical piece of evidence is lost, missing, stolen, whatever. She says it sarcastically, and my mood sinks lower, back to the dark space where it has been for weeks. How the hell does it matter what's in the news? Marino retorts. The FBI thinks it does, Janet says quietly, seriously. Not for the right reason, and that's the problem. It's always the problem. You're presenting information as if it's an undisputed fact, Donahue says to Lucy. You're basically stating irrefutably that Carrie has something to do with Kay's missing dive mask, and what I keep asking myself is why do you know anything about it? I think what she's trying to say is Carrie may not have ripped my mask off, but she recovered it, and now Lucy has the recording. I look squarely at my niece to see if she's going to deny this, and instantly I know she won't. Dear God, what have you done? I'll explain. Lucy stares out a window at the darkening sky. Holy shit! Please tell me you're kidding! Marino's eyes seem to bug out of his head. I don't understand how you got it from her, I say to Lucy as my inner alarm hammers. Damn it, Marino says loudly. Sorry, he apologizes to Desi. I didn't say I got the mask from her, Lucy replies. Or anything directly from her. Don't copy the way I talk, dude. Got it? Marino puts his arm around Desi, pulls him close, and vigorously knuckles his scalp. Ouch! Desi yells and giggles. You know what that's called? It's called a noogie.
Which is what schoolyard bullies do, Janet says.
Mom makes me pay when I use swear words. A quarter for damn, and 50 cents for shit, and a dollar if I say the F word. You're up to at least $1.25 so far,
Desi lets Marino know, and he continues to refer to his mother in the present tense. Did you have contact with Carrie? Did you see her? I ask Lucy, as calmly as I can muster. It's not what you might assume, Janet says, and I can't stop thinking of Lucy's recent trip to Bermuda. I know she went, but I didn't know she was going. She never mentioned it. Then days ago, I found out she'd been there, and Janet and Desi didn't go with her. Lucy doesn't seem inclined to explain herself beyond what she's already told me. She was on a dive trip. It wasn't a vacation. She was meeting a friend of Janet's. I have a feeling this person wasn't merely a social acquaintance.
What are we supposed to assume? Donahue asks Lucy.
Nothing. Don't assume anything.
I need you to tell me everything.
I never tell everything. Not to anyone.
You're going to have to with me if I'm going to represent you.
I'm not at liberty to reveal certain details, and it's up to you how to deal with that. Lucy is getting combative with her.
I'm not sure I can be of much use to you, then.
I'm not the one who called you, Lucy says to her as she looks at me. Don't go, I say to Donahue as she gathers her belongings and gets up from her chair. You need to stay, I say to her. You're representing me, too.
I'm worried this might not work.
Donahue picks up her pocketbook. Lucy, please. I give my niece a warning look, and she shrugs.
You should stay.
The way Lucy says it isn't very convincing, but it's enough.
Okay, then.
Donahue sits down, and Desi is looking back and forth at whoever is talking. He's a wise old soul. Small for his age, with a mop of pale brown hair and huge blue eyes. He shows no distress or angst, but he shouldn't be sitting here listening to this, and Marino can tell what I'm thinking.
I'll take him outside for a walk, he offers, clawing at mosquito bites that are angry wheels on his legs.
That sounds fun, doesn't it, Desi? Lucy moves chairs from a small table off the kitchenette, arranges them near the couch. I've been standing all this time because I've gotten stubborn about being the first one to sit. People assume I need to because of my legs, so I stand longer than I should, even if I'm miserable.
How about a walk with Marino?
Lucy encourages Desi.
No, I don't want to.
He shakes his head, and Janet puts her arm around him, hugs him close.
Yeah, you do.
Marino picks up a tube of Afterbite from the kitchen counter.
Tell me about the mini recorder.
Donahue directs this at me.
Give me any details you can.
But it's Lucy who answers her. She explains that U.S. Congressman Bob Rosado was shot to death June 14, 2 months ago, while diving off his yacht in South Florida. His scuba tank and part of his skull weren't found. And since it's a federal case, and I have federal jurisdiction through my military affiliation, I decided to meet Benton's tactical team in Fort Lauderdale. I showed up the next day, June 15, to help with their search and recovery efforts.
Is it routine for you to attach a mini recorder to your dive mask whenever you're doing an underwater recovery?
Donahue asks me. I wouldn't put it that way, because the camera is permanently mounted. I smell ammonia and tea tree oil as Marino slathers gel over his mosquito bites.
But you turn the camera on and off.
You do that manually and deliberately.
She slowly turns her coffee mug on the armrest of her chair, as if to imply we're talking in circles.
Yes, I answer. If for no other reason than to prevent questions about the procedures I used, about the veracity of my testimony. I like jurors to see where I found evidence. It's helpful if they can witness for themselves that it was properly handled and preserved. And in dive search and recoveries, it's especially important because there's no talking, no narrative, no explanation. You can't hear much underwater except bubbles.
So when you saw who you believe was Kerry Grethen, the camera on your mask was recording the entire time, Donahue says to me, and that's because you had turned it on.
That's correct.
Then Kerry should be on film. I start to answer that of course she will be, but the look in Lucy's eyes stops me. Something is wrong. Wherever my face was directed, the camera was recording it, I explain to Donahue as uncertainty stirs inside me. And there are no assumptions involved. It's not what I believe. It's about what's true. I know who I saw. I have no doubt you believe you do. It's not merely what I believe, but it is exactly that, Donahue says. It's what you believe, Kay, which isn't necessarily what's true. It happened fast, out of nowhere, the blink of an eye. You had Kerry Grethen on the brain, and then someone confronted you in not exactly optimal conditions. You just had the shock of discovering the two divers had been murdered by someone. By her. I know that's what you believe. I'm sure you're sincere. The visibility had to be pretty bad. Do you wear contact lenses when you dive? Is your mask prescription?
I know what I saw.
Let's hope we can prove it, she says. And Lucy has the same look in her eyes. Something is wrong.
This is what you really think?
I'm getting angry.
You think I was in shock, couldn't see, was confused, and misidentified whoever was down there with the spear gun?
We have to prove it, Donahue repeats. I'm giving you a dose of what the opposition will say.
And the opposition is the FBI, I reply.
What a sad thing to contemplate. And it seems I contemplate it all too often these days. When I was getting started, I was told that law enforcement was a public service. We're supposed to help people, not host inquisitions and persecute.
We absolutely view the FBI as the opposition, Donahue confirms. And I'm warming you up to what they'll say, what they're already saying, I'm willing to bet. We have to prove it absolutely was Kerry Grethen, that she absolutely isn't dead, that she absolutely is the one shooting people, including you. We have to demonstrate that she absolutely is, what are they calling the sniper?
Copperhead. Yes, that she's Copperhead. My eyes are on Lucy's face as she stares stonily at the Japanese sitcom no one is watching. Then she looks at me, and I don't like what I'm seeing. I feel iced water around my heart. I hear a whisper of doom. Something is wrong. I watched Kerry point a spear gun at me and pull the trigger. I feel as if I'm defending myself to Donahue, and I don't like it. She looked right at me from no more than 20 feet away, and I watched her shoot me. I heard the first spear hit my tank, and then the second spear hit, except I didn't hear that one. I felt it. I felt it like a cement truck slamming into my thigh.
It must have hurt so bad,
Desi exclaims, as if what I've said is new information. It's not. We've had many conversations about my being shot, and what it means, and did it hurt, and was I afraid of dying? He wants to know all about death, as he struggles to understand how it's possible that he'll never see his mother again. It's not been easy for me to handle his questions. I understand biological death. It's provable. A dead organism isn't going to limber up and get warm again.
It's not going to move or speak or suddenly walk into a room. But I'm not going to talk to Desi about the clinical finality of non-life, of physical non-existence. I'm not going to instill fear and fatalism into the mind of a little boy who just lost his mother. It would be selfish and unkind of me not to use a metaphor, an analogy or two that might offer hope and comfort. Death is like a trip to a place that has no email or phone. Or maybe think of it as time travel. Or something you can't touch, like the moon. I've gotten rather good at giving Desi unsound, pathological explanations that I halfway believe. Marino drops the tube of anti-itch gel on the kitchen counter. Come on, big buddy. Janet is rubbing Desi's back. You must be getting stir-crazy. How about a little fresh air before it rains? No, he shakes his head. Marino's really good at fishing, Lucy says. He's so good, the fish have his picture up in the post office to warn everybody. Grab this man. Watch out. Reward offered. Fish don't have a post office. How do you know that, huh? See, you can't unless you get some direct experience. Marino picks up Desi and holds him high in the air as he shrieks in delight. You want to know what kind of fish are in the water around here? You want to know what huge fish we could catch if we had poles right now? Desi decides he does, and Marino takes him out. I hear them on the dock. Then I don't. Chapter 22. I don't have the mask, Lucy says, but I've got access to the recording. You didn't recover my mask yourself. I have to be sure she wasn't anywhere near me when I lost it and almost died. Of course not. You couldn't have recovered it unless you were there when I was shot. I'd be devastated if I found out she was. It would change the history of my life and my entire worldview if I found out she was there. It's one of those things that I honestly might not want to know because the consequences would be irreversibly awful. I wasn't in Florida. Why would I shoot you? Lucy is saying. Why would I hurt you? Why would I allow anybody to hurt you? Why do you ask me? How could you think for even a minute it's not Kay thinking it? Donahue interrupts her. And this may be what they intend to prove. This may be the case they present to a grand jury. She directs this at me. That Lucy was in Florida and was present when you were shot because she's an accomplice to Carrie Grethen. Or worse, Lucy's the one who did it, and there is no Carrie Grethen. Maybe the FBI's position is that she really did die in a helicopter crash 13 years ago. Janet says this, and it sounds like more than a suggestion. And she looks at Lucy. And that you've fabricated everything about her. Exactly. Donahue is nodding. It's the scenario all of us should be worried about. But I'm curious, she says to me. What about Benton? He witnessed what happened. He saved your life. He must have looked right at the person who shot you. He must have been very close to this person. He didn't see her. I've asked Benton this many times, and his answer is always the same. When he realized I was in distress, that was it. He was completely preoccupied with me, and she must have fled. More likely, she hung back out of sight and watched, Lucy counters. So it sounds to me that if asked, Benton will say,